are listening to Into the Comics Cave with your host, comic book heartthrob, Grant Stoy.
Hello, this is Into the Comics Cave. I'm still Grant, but we have a new guest this week, as we do every week. But still, I'm very excited because this guy is not just one of the premier letterers in the biz. He is a writer that is very good, and I would say he's a comic bon vivant. I have Tobin Rossico with me. Hi, Tobin. How you doing, bud?
I'm great, Grant. I want to hear you speak more French. Where do I pay for that to happen?
So, my French is limited to what I saw in that Muzzy commercial. You remember Muzzy commercials?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh my gosh. In the States, they had the stupid, like, animated video person thing that they tried to push on kids to learn French.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things I said was, je suis la jeune fille. And I didn't learn later. That saying, like, I'm a little girl or something.
Nice.
Yeah, it's not good stuff. Oh, now that you have your glasses on, we are like before and after pictures of losing weight.
There you go. I don't know what that refers to, but I'll take it as a compliment. I'm not sure if it's whatever.
So, Tobin, now that I've got you here, I want to know. Where did you grow up?
Okay. This is going to be very exciting. Okay, so I grew up in what's essentially a 9 months out of the year, it's winter town surrounded by Indigenous reservations in Saskatchewan, Canada. And so I mention all those things because they're all very important into the lifestyle and stuff of all that stuff. So winter being so prominent meant that we spent a lot of time indoors, reading, playing games, watching movies, fighting over the two channels that we had to watch cartoons on.
Oh, geez.
And then growing up with like the weirdness of the tensions that come with that kind of culture clash was also very interesting. So then moving to a bigger city has been really nice because you're like, wow, yeah, there's more than just like wheat and hockey in life, right?
Everyone has different interests.
Yeah. And like food tastes good and stuff. Yeah. So the town was called Battleford, which also is very ironic because it was built as the premier trading post during the Louis Riel Rebellion. We're getting into some really hardcore Canadian history right now.
Well, this is actually very interesting because I know like exactly nothing about Canadian history.
Okay. All right. So here's your 5 minutes of like prairie history back in the 1800s. So Battleford was a Fort Battleford. It was a trading post that was basically between two really big centers. So you had like Fort Capel, which was in Alberta / kind of more northern Saskatchewan. Okay. And then like Winnipeg, although that's really far from where things would be, but still maybe like Regina is probably the better go between. So the Louis Riel Rebellion was essentially there. So you have right like Indigenous tribes like the Blackfoot and that kind of stuff that are all over Saskatchewan, Alberta. But then you have the Métis, which are when the French traders and settlers came in, they would marry the Indigenous women, have children, and that's what the blend was called, was Métis. Huh. So you have Métis people, you have Indigenous tribes, then you have, of course, white settlers. And pretty soon the Métis started realizing like, hey, we're not getting the benefits of any of this trade or culture or economy that's happening. And so they are really kind of the ones that were pushed to the side. So this gentleman, Louis Riel, who is Métis, was like, well, I'm going to do something about it. And so he'd organized all these tribes and stuff. And basically it was a rebellion. They fought back against the governments and all that stuff. And so it kind of enveloped like central Canada for 10-ish years, maybe something like that.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, from like Winnipeg and Manitoba all through Saskatchewan and chunks of Alberta, like big, big, big battles. Where I grew up was kind of the halfway point. It was built because we have the Saskatchewan River, which kind of split Saskatchewan in half from Alberta all the way down through Manitoba. And so, of course, waterways are important in those kind of military operations. And so it was a trading post and a big military fort. It's a really weird place because they, I'm trying to remember the correct word, they hanged multiple First Nations chiefs there.
Oh, geez.
So that's kind of crazy. And what was the other thing? There's something else significant, but it's slipping my mind. So it's probably not that important if I can't remember it. And so, yeah, in school, right, we'd have like our social studies lessons and we'd learn that kind of stuff. And then we'd go to the fort and be like, this is where, like, these are the barracks. This is the jail. This is like where they would keep stuff and then do all this kind of stuff. And then we'd walk down and it's like, this is the grave where these chiefs are buried.
Oh, my gosh.
From that kind of thing. So, yeah, it was a very prominent part of that culture and that history. For good and for bad, but it was very interesting to have that kind of as a main point of like study and focus all through my history and or all through my childhood, essentially.
Right. The two things. Number one, that was incredibly informative. I had no idea, and this is stuff I want to look up later. And number two, your professor is showing. Mm. Tobin is also has doing some professoring.
Yep. Not of things probably that matter that much, but it's been fun nonetheless.
Would you like to share what you have taught at the collegiate level?
Sure. Yeah. So I have the very fortunate privilege of having taught perhaps the nerdiest courses that have existed in that you can get university credits for, I guess I should say. So I started with teaching game studies, which is exactly what it sounds. You study video games, board games, card games, all that kind of stuff. And then I taught Harry Potter, and I've been a TA in the Lord of the Rings courses, both graduate level and undergraduate level. And then I taught the superhero, yeah. And I don't think there's one that I'm missing, because there's not like The Witcher or what would be an equivalent. You know, Harry Potter is probably the most impactful. I guess we have like fantasy and science fiction, but for like named, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, and then superhero and comics, or superhero, because that encompasses comics, and then game studies. That's kind of it, right? Am I missing anything?
Didn't you teach a D&D lesson plan or something?
I mean, I'm working on that. So those are the nerdy things, but then I also taught like communication and engineering, communication and sciences. But when I finally get my like introduction to English course, I'm teaching that through playing D&D. Yeah, that's the plan.
I'll do that.
But that is yet to actually happen.
That's going to be really rad.
Yeah.
So I'd like to know, when about did you encounter sequential art and comics during this time in Battleford?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's kind of multiple points where I was introduced to it, but it didn't really stick. And I'll illustrate that with these stories. So when I was a kid, so I guess the other thing to understand about Battleford is like the most exciting thing that we would do is basically like a Saturday matinee of, Anastasia or like Atlantis, right? That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There was nowhere you could go to buy. I don't even know if we could buy books. I think the only time that we ever bought new books were at like Scholastic book orders and book fairs.
Okay.
I mean, we had a Walmart. I think I was 8 or 9 when we got our first Walmart. And beyond that, we'd have to drive an hour and a half to like an actual city that had like a Kohl's or something like that for actual books. So it, being exposed to comics proper, I would say I was 18.
Oh, wow.
But sequential art began with Archie comics, because could go to the grocery store, right? And or the supermarket, I guess. It wasn't really even a grocery store. And get your double digests and that kind of stuff. But we would get them mostly from yard sales, or like my older siblings would get them from their friends because their little siblings were done with them and be like, here, you have little brothers and sisters, give them these. And so that's kind of where it started. So we'd read those on the way to the lake and on the way to, where we'd go camping and stuff. So that's really like the origin of sequential art would be Archie comics. But then when I was 14, so not really even, I might have had my first job by then, I think. Yeah, because I was playing music by then, so I was buying hardware and cymbals and stuff, so I was making money. We found Shonen Jump. So if you don't know what Shonen Jump is, it's the monthly anthology of manga. And the reason why I found it, actually, I was in the city. I wasn't even in my town proper yet. So I was in the city. We were at Kohl's probably. And I was like, I can buy this $16 book and also get a Yu-Gi-Oh card. Because that's very integral into this origin story. Because I would not have purchased it if I didn't get this ultra rare Yu-Gi-Oh card. Because at the time, what I would do is I would become a member of all these different Yu-Gi-Oh forums and type out, like, here's the cards I own that I want to trade. Here's all the cards I'm looking for. And we'd comment on each other's posts saying, like, oh, I have a Lava Golem, but I want your Dark Paladin. Does that sound fair? And so we'd say, yep. We'd send each other our physical mailing addresses. And on the honor system, we would mail cards, not even across, like, the country or the continent, like across the world. I would ship cards to Singapore and Israel and Australia and New Zealand and Boston and, you know, local or places, but literally like Yu-Gi-Oh cards traveling the planet to my mailbox.
Amazing.
So that was the motivation to pick up Shonen Jump. So then I started reading Shonen Jump. And that's where I read like Naruto and One Piece and Hikaru no Go and Eye Shield, like, you know, that kind of like really exactly for my age range stories. And was just flabbergasted. Like the stuff that I remember seeing in that first Shonen Jump, like, is forever burned in my brain. So then I convinced my parents to get a subscription because it was dirt cheap. You'd get these huge magazines of like 500, 600 pages for like $8. Like, wow. You know, you don't get better value than that in comics. Ever. I don't think you could ever, you know, get to that quantity. So I did that for a long time. Then I kind of fell off of it because they started bringing in series that I didn't really care about. So I fell off of that. And then all through high school, it was really just like video games and music. So then when I finished high school and I was working a full-time job and I had my license, I could go to the city whenever I wanted. I watched the Scott Pilgrim movie and was again blown away by just visual storytelling. I didn't know that movies could be like that. And then it's like, hey, if you like this, go buy the comics. And I thought, well, you know, I have Shonen Jump in my bedroom still, like I can read some comics. So I went and bought the box set, and walking into a comic book store that first time, it really was like, wow, this is where I belong.
Oh, nice.
And that feeling of like, there's something for me here, but I need to spend a good couple of days like digging through stuff. And so I read Scott Pilgrim. And then from that, going back and forth is where I found writers like Rick Remender and Jonathan Hickman and kind of those other Marvel writers around, what would that have been, 2011, before they made the jump to Image. I guess Hickman started at Image, so that doesn't really count. But, you know,
yeah.
Like Brubaker was just kind of getting into Image. Remender hadn't really, although I guess he had as well. He's been doing independent before then. So that kind of stuff. And then it was also, and I'm like kind of ashamed that this is a big part of it because I feel like it's a part of everybody's comic origin, but The Dark Knight Returns was what made me realize like what is possible in a sequential art storytelling medium, because I remember reading it, and that's a whole other story that we'll do at a different episode because I don't want to retell that story, but I remember reading it and going, okay, there's things happening with what the character is doing, right? They're posing. But then there's stuff in the background that's also telling a story. And then the dialogue's telling a story. And then this caption's telling a story. So like all that stuff clicked. And it literally was like somebody took a Lego piece and went click. And you just had that really satisfying feeling. And I went, oh, I get it. Okay, I want to do this.
And what was your first foray into comics like?
Expensive. Right. I didn't come from that like spinner rack era of like, oh, I have 60 cents. I'm going to go buy 12 comics. Right. And so, yeah, it literally was like, okay, I have my budget for 2 comics a month. And so I'd read Rick Remender's Venom.
Nice.
And I think it was Hickman was just starting FF. And those were the 2.
Oh, man. Those are really good. That was a great time.
Yeah. I still have the number 1 Venom, and that's like the one comic that I kept from all of my floppies collecting and stuff is Venom number 1. So I say expensive mostly because the conversion rate is crazy when it comes to buying comics in Canada, but comics now are also more expensive. And I also, at the time, I didn't understand what trades were. So if I were a smarter consumer, I would have been like, oh, I could buy, you know, five floppies for $30, or I could buy this trade for half that, or, you know, $20 at least. So that's why I say expensive, is that was a very rough rookie mistake to learn, where I could have had significantly more comics for my buck. But it was fun. And again, because I live so far away, I remember actually there was a few friends from high school. And so they'd be going into the city and I'd say, hey, would you go to the comic shop and pick up this comic for me? And they did it, thankfully. But that was sometimes the only time, or the only way, that I could read the monthly releases that month, because of work or other stuff like that. Or, you know, I'm not going to drive 3 hours to buy one book or something like that, right? But I just remember it being really fascinating, because reading monthly releases obviously is very different than a trade. And so it was the first time where I would read, I mean, and they're thin, right? Like 20 pages really isn't a lot, I say to the person who writes 20 page floppies as well.
I'm making a bunch of old. I'm like, oh, I'm writing 24 now. Maybe that'll help.
But I remember getting to those to be continued, right? And being like, oh man, 4 weeks is going to take forever. And I didn't experience that with Shonen Jump, because you literally have 500 pages. So if you weren't satisfied with that, it's like, okay, well then, like, that's really on you if you can't be satisfied with 500 pages. So that was tricky. And I think that's really what motivates me to do both bigger single issues, but then also with Crown and Anchor, by just doing the like trade releases as the main way that we put out content. Cause like, I want people to feel like they're getting their money's worth, and I want the wait to be worth it. And I want the point to be like, you know, cause I would get Venom number 4 and I'd read number 4 and I'd be like, well, let's read 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then 1, 2, right? Like, you have to do that. And it was, again, before trades release. So I didn't even understand that they were supposed to be in like one singular book. I thought it was just like, yeah, you get floppies forever. And if it's like a really well-selling thing like Spider-Man or Batman, like, yeah, they'll be collected because that makes sense. But I didn't know that everything does at a certain point, right? So yeah, I learned a few things and made some personal decisions about how I want to produce work based on that. Because it was not accessible. And it was, you know, before Comixology, before anything like that. So it really was this like, I got to save my pennies, and it hopefully is worth it. And most cases it was.
And when did you decide, I want to do this? And sub question, what aspect did you try first? Did you try writing or lettering first? Did you try art?
I never tried art. Although maybe as like a very deep reward tier, I could show you a comic that I tried to draw. Although I might have thrown that out. We might not have the book anymore.
Oh, but no!
You could ask Alaire about it. It was terrible. Actually, she might still have screenshots of it on her Facebook, so she might be able to pull it up. So where it came from was actually not comics. So I had wanted to be a writer in some capacity since I was in grade 4. I was reading, there's this Canadian author named Eric Wilson, and he wrote these young adult mystery novels about a brother and sister. I don't remember their names, but it was essentially, you know, it was very Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew kind of stuff, but like super Canadian. to the point where it was like, we're going to go to Regina and something happened at the legislature. And I was like, I've been there. This is super cool, right? Like, it was relatable in a way that watching TV wasn't, because everything was filtered through a US lens. And I was like, yeah, whatever. That's just typical TV. But like, reading that was really, really exciting. So I was like, I'm going to write mystery novels. And so I remember spending this one summer planning out novels and, you know, getting like 3 pages into it and my hand cramping and thinking, yeah, no, this isn't for me. So, and then, yeah, throughout a huge different times of my life, I was a really avid reader, and then I was a very against reading and stuff like that. So what happened was, my last semester of high school, I worked at a library, and I didn't want anything to do with the book. And then I quit there, and I worked, I was working my like full-time job. I worked in a kitchen at a mental hospital. So prepare your questions for that for the second episode, because I got some fun stories. And I actually, I don't remember how I found it. It might have been a friend recommended it, but I started reading The Hunger Games, right? Okay. So imagine 18-year-old Tobin, no friends, because at that point I didn't have any friends left. And I was reading The Hunger Games, and it just blew my mind. And I don't know what about it was so evocative. It might have just been because I was in like such a drought for just good storytelling. But the world, I think, was really exciting overall. Yeah. It was a genre that I hadn't really been exposed to. And I mean, say what you will about the genre and whatnot, but like that first book is pretty well crafted. And so I was like, I want to do post-apocalyptic stuff. Like, that's really cool. So I kind of mixed my experiences working at the hospital with like some, you know, some of this history that I knew from where I grew up. And then it almost was like this weird alternative future, like Blade Runner mixed with like a lot of specifically Battleford history, which was really weird. And I started just typing stuff out. And I remember sending it to my brother and he's like, this is really cool. And obviously, you know, it's the family response, but I feel like my brother's the type of person who, if it was crap, he would say, nah, this isn't really that exciting.
Yeah.
So I started doing that stuff and I was like, wow, writing prose is really, really, really hard because you have to think of everything. You have to identify everything and, you know, whatever. And that was before, I think that was actually before I actually read comics. And so there was this history of wanting to write. And then I think getting exposed to comics made me realize I don't have to be as specific because I don't need to say all the things because somebody else is doing the heavier lifting.
Yeah.
And, you know, different writers will disagree with that probably, but I'm pretty lazy because I trust that my artists will do what they do, which is art. So the writing came first. I didn't understand, you know, like how panels work and how many panels should be on a page and that kind of thing. It was very rough, but I remember handwriting out some scripts and basically just, it's almost what I do now, but each line was kind of a panel, which is kind of how I plot my stuff now. And then, so that was what, like 2011 to 2013. I start college in 2014. I meet Alaire that fall. And I have had maybe 15, 16 issues of just random stuff done by that point, you know, and I don't think I'd shown any of it to anybody. I'd attempted to go to some book clubs. That sounds weird. Writing groups. That's what they would be called. in college, my first couple semesters to be like, I'm going to show these to people. They're going to be blown away. But it was literally people who were like, this is number 6 of my 10 book volume.
Oh God!
I wrote 3,000 words this week. What do you think? And just being like, this is not what I thought this was going to be, right? So I hadn't shown them to a lot of people. And then Alaire and I link up. We start making comics, and I start showing her stuff. And you know, some of it resonated. Some of it was not super great. Is a lot of it was inspired by like Chew and Invincible and that kind of thing, right? Because that's what was really, really cool back then. I mean, it's still cool now. Whatever.
I was going to say, Chew is still pretty cool.
Yeah, Chew is a masterpiece, that's for sure. So she starts doing some art for webcomics, and then it's around that time where I start feeling really guilty because we're two poor college students, and she's working until midnight on pages, and I'm at home playing Halo with my roommates. And I go, I probably should be contributing more to this to have it be a little bit more balanced. And so that's when I thought, oh, okay, well, I'll start lettering. And so I lettered terribly for about 6 months. And then I met Ed Brisson at a local convention back in Saskatchewan, back in Saskatoon. Asked him a bunch of questions. We corresponded via email for a good couple months after that. And the job was 3 months. And then it was a lot of like emailing editors at Marvel to be like, hey, give me portfolio reviews, and emailing professionals like Nate Picos and there's a ton of them. A lot of people got a lot of excited emails from me and told me how crappy my work was and all that. So I've never tried art. I was actually taught how to flat by a professor.
Oh, really?
He taught me how to flat, and I thought, yeah, this is great. And then I realized, why am I flatting a page? And it's taking me, you know, an hour, and I'm going to make $10 when I could letter like 4 or 5 pages in that time and make 5 times as much. So it was like 2 weeks where I thought, yeah, this is fun. And then I thought, this is a complete waste of my time. And this is not something that I want to develop skills for. So that was my only
realization.
Yeah, no, it was terrible. My hands aren't built for that. Mouse and keyboard, not stylus. No, thanks.
It's funny to hear that. I getting into lettering is something that I think seems so easy on the surface, but then once someone tries it, they're like, this is impossible. I know I tried and then I immediately threw up my hands and said, no, thank you. So to hear that you and others just keep going, okay, let's keep working on this to make it work. That kind of perseverance is pretty cool.
Yeah, thanks. It's fun. I mean, it did take, there was multiple times where I thought, this is really dumb. But what really made it click, so the way that my brain works is I have to relate everything down to Legos. And if I can understand how something is just this version of Legos, then it all makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I remember the moment where that happened, I was like, oh, it's just layers. So if I put something on top of this, it's just a Lego on top of a Lego, and that's the Lego that's going to be seen. And that was it. For the most part, that was like, okay, the foundation is built. And then everything after that was, you know, design, because that's all lettering essentially is just design that you're tricking readers into not really taking notice of.
And then you became a master builder and
I glued all the pieces together.
But Tobin, I have a question for you.
Uh-huh.
So let's say that you are waiting in line for some delicious chicken McNuggets.
Okay. And I think you have me confused with Alaire. Do you have a question?
Well, I mean, they're not for you.
Oh, okay.
So you get the nuggets and you just want to make sure that they're all there and you open up the top and the genie comes out.
Mm.
And the genie says, hey, I will make you the best at two things. However, every time you fart, it's going to be a secret. Anyone near you is going to hear one of your deepest, darkest secrets.
Oh, okay.
So first question is, what two things would you want to be the best at? Number two, would you still want those even if every time you farted, nearby would hear your secrets?
Would you trade it for a number two? Yeah, of course I would say, whatever. I mean, I feel like my secrets aren't super dark, but it's worth it, right? I would pick, so the first thought that came to mind was guitar. Because that's something I've always wanted to learn. And that was something that I should have used my time better at during the pandemic, was to finally pick up guitar. So that was the first thought. I don't think that's an actual answer. I think it would be drumming, because that is what my foundation of music is in. So why not just finish with that and do that? So that's the one I'll go with, is I'll be the best at drumming. The second one would probably be, okay. Actually, I'm going to scrap that. So here's some fun stuff that I've like never talked about with people before. So you know how you always hear people who are like, I just turned 40. It's funny talking to you about this.
You're striking close to home. So tread lightly.
Yeah. People who are like, I just turned 40. I need to make a change in my life. And so they quit their day job and they're like, I'm going to make goat soap. Have you heard stories like that?
Oh, yeah. It's the classic midlife crisis.
Yeah. But, okay. So you hear that, but you only hear that when it actually works for them and it sticks, right? You don't hear the people that are like, yeah, I quit my job and I lost my 401k and I made goat soap and now I'm back with my parents, right? You don't hear those kind of stories. Anyways, so we've been joking, Alaire and I, because I turned 30 this year and I'm like having a, whatever that is, third life crisis, one third of life crisis. If I live to 90, that's way too long. So I don't know, two-fifths?
I'm not blew past the quarter life crisis. I don't know what this is.
Well, that was when I got married. Okay. So Alaire and I have been joking that if, you know, being a professor doesn't work and comics doesn't work, the first thought I had was, I'm going to throw everything in and I'm going to make candy.
I thought you were going to say goat soap. Lead up to goat soap.
Going to be this old man making candy in his basement and then driving around his white van trying to sell it.
White windowless van.
Yeah. So I had that thought. So that was the one thing. But then there was something else the other day where I was like, oh, that's actually what I want to do. So anyway, so we'll come back to candy. So I want to be like the Willy Wonka, right? So that'll be what that would be what I would want to be. I would want to be the best candy maker. For that. And then the other one is basically just if like Professor and all that stuff doesn't work out and Candy Maker doesn't work out, I'm literally just gonna like have a food cart and sell burgers. And I'd always come back to this idea of making food and selling food. But the startup cost is ridiculous, right? So anyway, so that would probably be it. I would want to make like the best burger. Cause right, you go to some town, you go to Portland and you have something that literally is the best burger. Like you'd be set.
Okay, I just want to run this by you again. You said you don't want to be the best guitarist or the best drummer.
Have you toured with a musical group?
I would imagine being the best at guitar, the tour is probably a lot easier.
Yeah, but you're still like on a bus and planes. Have you been on a plane recently, Grant? It's not fun. Yeah, it's terrible. Like, because that's what I realized when I was in high school. I remember we did 3 shows in the space of a week and it was terrible. And we were only driving like an hour. And I thought, I'm going to do this and like drive across the country for months at a time with people. I mean, I like the people I was playing with, but you know, like that's what I'm really signing up for. So it was a very microscopic taste into what the actual lifestyle would be. No, not for me. I would much prefer to just like lay on the floor than do that. That's how much excitement.
Like literally,
it was.
Lay
yeah,
floor.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So no, I would want to do that. I think instead. So those would be the two. So the best candy maker, the best burger maker, and then yeah, let all of my farts be heard.
Now, what if your farts, the smell of your farts was also dialed up?
Oh, I don't think that's possible. I think we're at the echelon all the time.
we're at max 2.
Yeah, we're at what is it? We're at DEFCON, whatever the numbers work for DEFCON.
the big one, the top DEFCON.
Yeah.
Well, now that we've settled that you are quite fine with your colon telling your secrets, we're going to move on to the final 5 questions.
Also, hold on. Can I footnote? Is it like I fart and the genie is like, Tobin Rossico cheated in grade 4. Like, is my name associated with it?
Oh, no. It's like your butt is blowing out words.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's like, it's not even like a like a cheek slapping kind of fart.
Sure.
It's like one of those.
Okay.
And it just is like, Tobin.
smoker voice, butt farts.
I don't know what your anus would sound like.
So it's like the parcel mouth of farts. So we have like anus tongue, which
yes,
that's not safe for work. Don't Google that, people.
Now we're going with that. You get cursed with anal.
Because they call them parcel tongues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Parcel mouth, parcel tongues, anus. I'm trying to think of other words that are like language associated. What's some D&D terms for speaking?
I just vocal. Like an anal whisperer. Or like an anal murmur.
That's my OnlyFans name. An anal murmur. Yeah, I have a heart murmur and an anal murmur. One of them will kill me and one of them will embarrass me.
Oh, that'd be funny if you were like serving up a burger and you farted and it was like, he sneezed in the beef.
Oh man, could you imagine? People don't care about that stuff anymore. Everybody knows what they're getting when they get fast food.
Another sad but true.
Okay, thanks for indulging me. That's as far as we need to go down that rabbit hole.
So 5 questions we ask every guest.
Okay.
Derived from James Lipton, yada yada. Seatbelt buckle.
Is that the soup maker?
James Lipton?
Yeah. I'm just trying to be anyways.
Are you trying to be flippant about this very serious?
Yeah.
So number 1.
We can't go from anal whispers to like seriousness that fast.
that would be absurd. Number 1, and I feel like you're a good person to ask because you write and letter.
Okay.
What is your favorite sequential art sound effect?
Oh man. Okay. So there's always a special place in my heart for the yoink that I wrote in Side Quest number 1, only because. If you've played Halo Reach, that was such a huge part of that game because they introduced in that game, this is where the history comes from, is they introduced assassinations in that game. So if you like ran up behind another Spartan or any character, but I guess in PvP, and you meleeed them, you do this animation where the camera would cut away and you'd like garrot them a little bit, or garrot, yeah, and then like stab them in the head. And so that would be the assassination. But if a team member saw that happen and they shot the person that you're trying to assassinate before the animation finished, you would get a yoink medal.
That's amazing.
And so me and my buddy Watson playing Reach would always be like, I yoinked you. And it was like this huge thing. So anyways, so that's where that comes from. So yoink is very good. If it was actually onomatopoetic and not just, you know, this thing that like Sean Murphy would do where he'd be like, gun, reload, right? You're not just like stating a verb. I mean, I like blam. That's probably a little bit too basic. I'm not one of these people who, I guess I fluctuate. If the book demands that the sounds be a little bit more realistic in terms of, you know, like, what is the sound of a lightsaber turning on? Okay, well, let me figure out what those letters are. But if it's something, you know, as simple as blam and it works, that's great. So I don't know. I don't know if I have a designy answer to that. I think it's just yoink. I also don't use a ton of sound effects in my own work anymore. So I'm trying to think what I've done in side quest and stuff, because I feel like I have lots of fun with those.
Yeah, and this is where I have to make it known that that yoink was 100% your idea, yeah, and it worked out so well.
Yeah, we'll say that, just because I can't think of anything better, because I don't know if there is anything better at that point. So yeah. I think it fit that scene and like the mood of those characters so well.
It was like just, it was a perfect, because it was the last panel of the first page.
Yeah.
And it just works so well because you immediately want to see what's going on, who yoinked it.
So I think that's what makes this answer so hard, is like, I can have a favorite, but if the scene doesn't call for it, you're never going to see it. So more often than not, the favorite is like when the thing actually works within the actual scene, which yoink, I think, is like, you know, put that on my gravestone, because I don't know if there's going to be anything that's more appropriate than that. So that's all I'll say.
So number two, what is something that you love about sequential art?
Oh man, that's a great question. So I actually, here's a fun story. I gave a guest lecture last term in the superhero course because I wasn't teaching it, and I called it 6 comics mechanics that you don't know comics do. I don't remember what it was, something really facetious. And then it was like, you won't believe number 4. But I talked about stuff like eye path and page turns and sound effects and like how time works in comics. I talked about lettering. I don't remember how many that is, but I think I'm missing one or two. So I would probably say, because this is what I write, or how I write more so now, I fixate on it, is like having a good page turn. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I focus on this so much is because the example I gave in my guest lecture is, and here's some spoilers for a book that came out 20 years ago, 18 years ago, something like that. I think it's 16 years ago. It's Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. So skip to whatever timestamp Grant puts in the notes.
Spoiler alert, if you are
if you're not one of the billion people that read this book, then okay. So if you're reading Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, Harry's on the astronomy tower, Dumbledore's on the astronomy tower, Snape comes into the astronomy tower, and you know, Severus, please, Avada Kedavra, boom. In fiction, you don't have control of where that revelation happens, right? You could have it in the middle of the page. It could be at the top of the first page, meaning the left-hand page. It could be at the middle of the right-hand page. Like, you have no control because of everything else that happens before it. In comics, though, you could have at the very bottom on the right-hand page, Dumbledore, Severus, please. Severus looking really, really angry. You turn the page and you see the spell happen, right? So that kind of control of when you reveal things or when you don't reveal things is something that is really, really powerful in comics. And I remember listening when I was like really obsessed, right, with learning the craft and listening to podcasts of a bunch of different writers. Jonathan Hickman talked about this one concept that I try to, it's like one of my comic mantras, which is the revelation of secrets creates suspense better than the withholding of secrets.
Okay.
which is another reason why I think that side quest is really great, is because you do that really well, and like it doesn't even feel forced. It's just like, this is the natural way that these characters would find things out. So with that in mind, when you're scripting, you should always, right, you're always dangling the carrot in front of the reader, meaning that whatever's happening at the bottom of the right-hand page should be so enticing that they want to turn that page, no matter how much time they have left to read, no matter how long they have been reading, right? Like every single page turn should be super, super enthralling and exciting. So that's what I would say. And then there's such cool things that you can do with that, right? You can do sound effects that like bleed off into that panel. Captions that like do the baton passing. Joshua Williamson is really good with that in Birthright, where there'll be a caption that introduces like what the speaker on the page is saying. So you're getting that scene transition even before. So it's bridging that gap. There's tons of stuff, but I think that ultimately is what is really exciting about it, is that we have the control, because we can say we want 4 panels on this page and then we want 6. And that 6th panel is going to have this, so that when you turn the page, this is the result, right? So you can really have some fun with that.
This just makes me very angry that you don't have an online course about comics, because I would like to take it. I'm sure everyone else would like to sit down on it as well.
Well, it's all, I guess this is just what academia is, but I've just like stolen great concepts from other people who actually know more than me. But yeah, no, I think about this stuff a lot, because I think it is, I recognize it in the comics that inspire me. And so if I can, you know, do it somewhat as professionally as them, then hopefully the product turns out well.
Yeah. And kind of going to the other side of that equation, what is something about sequential art that you dislike?
Oh, how freaking long it takes, Grant.
It's so long.
we're just wrapping up side quest, not side quest.
No, there's still many miles to go before you get like, there.
If only we could wrap up side quest. we're just wrapping up Pilgrim's Dirge number 2. And like, I don't know what your backlog of projects is. Mine, so when I was figuring out what I wanted to spend my pandemic years doing, at least 2022, I wrote, I think, it's either 13 or 17 graphic novels worth of stories.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was a ton. So like, I finished all of Crown and Anchor. I finished all the Pilgrim's Dirge. Like I crank stuff out. There was times where I wrote 5 issues in like 3 weeks, because of just how stuff was flowing. And so I have that stack of scripts, and I see that it takes, you know, 8 months to do a creator-owned book, and you know how stressful Kickstarters are, and you know all this stuff. I'm preaching to the choir here, right? How long it takes, and I wish I could go faster, but there's also something that's like equally as stressful as having it come out faster, because then it's like, well, because I think about this a lot. So I produce 3 books, right? Mm-hmm. Pilgrim's Dirge, Emulator, and Crown Anchor. And when we plan out how we're going to release the stuff, I'm like, well, people just spend a good chunk of money on Crown Anchor because that's our hefty book, and then Pilgrim's Dirge is going to be this much, and then Emulator is going to be this much, and if they're too close together, like their budget's shot.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm again coming back from that experience of me being an 18-year-old trying to get books every month. Like, I understand how expensive this stuff is and how much of a luxury it is. And so I don't want people to run out of their budget and that kind of stuff. Right. I want them to be able to afford it. And so when it coalesces all together and you have all the releases lining up, it's like just as stressful, because now I'm like, oh crap, I could release it. And everybody's going to be like, well, we just backed SideQuest 4. So. Sorry, Tobin, no emulator for me this year, right? So like that kind of stuff is so tricky. So I guess that's a twofer, how long it takes and like how picky and choosy you need to be, because, you know, we're not Image who can price stuff at $350 and print 10,000 copies so we actually profit off of it, right? We have to be very, very specific in like, we have to price it this way because otherwise, you know, it's just, yeah. So there you go. The time and money of sequential art is really tricky to be a producer of.
Oh yeah. That's more than fair. Number 4. I like this one because you are also a parent. Oh, what boy. Is your favorite swear word that's not a swear word?
Okay. So we're trying really hard to, I mean, we don't use profanity much in the house. We use lots of fun substitutes. So I think it's monkey fighting as my as my replacement. And then we say gosh, so be like, oh gosh, or oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. And then holy, I think it's holy bananas is the other one that I say a lot. So I guess there's a theme, monkey fighting and holy bananas. Say,
this is really simian related.
It's very odd. So our son has gotten into the habit of saying holy gosh, which is like a bit too close for comfort for mm-hmm. other things.
I just can't stop thinking. I'm tired of all these monkey fighting snakes. Yeah,
I think that's where it came from. Honestly, is it just finally made its way into Alexa. Okay, there is one. I'm trying to think if it's in like Fawlty Towers or something. I can't think of it. But there's some like swear replacement. I think that Basil Fawlty says that's super funny, and I can't think of it right now. So there you go. Those are my personal choices, I guess. So it's not super spicy, but it does the job.
And you can always just send me a DM at 2 a.m. when your brain finally regurgitates what the word is.
Yeah.
So yeah, Tobin, I got some bad news for you. You finally got your wish and you fell into a candy factory.
Oh boy.
And you just went absolutely berserk. You consumed more sugar than anyone has ever consumed before. And your body just essentially crystallized and you died because you became sugar.
Okay.
So let's assume that you go to what we perceive to be heaven.
Okay.
And when you get there, you see a small, surly, gray-haired man sitting at a drafting table in a wife beater, and he's working furiously on this crazy spread with lots of circular things and people in crazy costumes, and it is Jacob Kurtzberg, a.k.a. Jack Kirby.
Mm.
What do you hope he says to you?
I didn't know that was his name.
Yes, it is.
What does he say to me? I don't think he would say it. Okay.
Well, that's really defeatist.
The reason why I say that. I'm one of these people who could not give a fart that tells my secrets about like that era of comics.
Oh my God.
Let the hate rain down. I just farted, so that can be one of my secrets. But like, I don't understand these people who will bleed for Jack Kirby and like that era of producers. Obviously, they set a foundation that, you know, is that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And modern comics would not be the same without them. Well, modern storytelling, what, like, I get it. But this comes from, you know, I don't understand why we still study Shakespeare. I don't understand why we still study Jane Austen. I don't understand why there is a canon. And if there is a canon of comics, obviously Kirby stuff is going to be in there. Mm-hmm. But I'm the kind of person who disavows all of that and says, okay, what are people doing now? What's important now? Who are the people who, you know, who are the modern Jack Kirby? And I hate using that as well, because I don't think that kind of, again, like, pedestal is good to produce in this kind of an industry, because then you just create another outlier and that kind of stuff. So if I noticed it was him, I'd be like, hey, thanks. But I'd keep on walking, because I'd be very confused as to why Jacob Kurtzberg is in a wife beater smoking his cigar in heaven. Like, why are there cigars in heaven? Anyways, but yeah. So yeah, let whatever opinions form about that, but that's honestly how I feel about like all kind of media. It's the same reason why like I've never watched Citizen Kane and even Blade Runner, despite all the times I've tried watching it. Like, I understand that stuff is paramount for the development of this industry and the storytelling medium and stuff like that, but I don't care, because it's ultimately outdated. This is also going to sound really bad. It's ultimately outdated, and what people are doing now should be given more of a spotlight than continually focusing on like the trailblazers of it. I think there comes a point where we have to say thanks so long.
Yeah, I agree to an extent. And I think it can also just boil down to sometimes it grabs you and sometimes it doesn't.
I think his stuff is awesome. Like, the reason why I love Nick Dragotta is because he's essentially a modern Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
you look at Kirby's faces, you look at Dragada's faces, it's like one-to-one. But again, Dragada's bringing in manga influences. He's bringing in, you know, Eastern storytelling aesthetics and stuff. And so, like, for me, that's the kind of stuff I want to see. It's like, sure, bring it forward, but don't just give me, like, Fantastic Four number one and say, this is the greatest thing ever. Because, like, no, it's not.
Dragada's also working with better writers.
That's true. So, yeah, what was your point? Sorry, say it again. What was your point?
Oh, sometimes stuff just doesn't grab you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, so yeah, I can understand his aesthetic. Like, I like it. I think it's, you know, again, I understand why it's impactful. But there's some reasons why I don't have Kirby books on my thing. And okay, so I guess the other reason is not only do people champion it so hard that they will die on that hill, but I find that people just kind of want to do their own version of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So something like Mr. Miracle by Tom King and Mitch, like, I feel like it's just a love letter to that. Like, doesn't he show up in that book? Like, he's in it?
To be honest, I didn't finish it.
Okay, that's totally fair. And I do not blame you for that. But that's what I mean, right? Is like, they can't get away from it. They're always trying to, like, haul that stuff forward and be like, look, we're honoring him. We're doing what he was doing. It's like, well, obviously you're in the same industry, but, like, do your own stuff. Right. And that's really why, if you ask, like, Allaire, will you ever work for Marvel in DC? She'll be the first one to be like, hell no, there's no way that I'm doing that kind of stuff. Why? Because you're just telling somebody else's story. So if you're continually going back to Kirby to, like, I'm going to, you know, do a fanboy comic about that, or I'm going to do my version of Fantastic Four or whatever, it's like, no, how about we get more stories like SideQuest or more stories like Chronicle, where it's like completely disavowing whatever has happened in the past, and it's just, this is what I think is cool, and I'm going to do that. Which, of course, comes with the caveat, because if people think that Jack Kirby is cool, they're going to do that. So I understand that my logic is not completely sound. I'm just speaking very emotionally at 10:30 p.m. after a very long day. So,
speaking right from the anus.
That's right. Fart whispers. Here we go.
Well, Tobin, thank you so much for joining me. Where can folks find you on the socials?
I'm a very misanthropic socialer. you really only get posts when I have like books coming out, which I know is not great, because then I'm just a salesman, not a person. So I'm semi-active on Twitter at Tobin Rossico. Allaire and I have a site, rossico.art. sign up for the newsletter. That's the best way to see the things that happen, right? So for this year, I've been doing, like, talking head videos about where our influences come from. So you get to hear me talk about Final Fantasy and manga and why One Piece was so amazing and different things like that. So that's probably the best way to keep in touch. Twitter, whatever. I don't do anything else. Oh, I have an art station, but I haven't updated that in a long time. I should do that. I should update my portfolio. It's a good reminder for that. And then I was streaming on Twitch. I would stream games, but that's not really something that I care to, like, have people spend their time doing.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Grant. This is fun.
This has been a Comic Book Yeti production. You can find new episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and anywhere podcasts stream. For more information on the Comic Book Yeti, please visit comicbookyeti.com. And for more of Grant, visit grantstoy.com or on Twitter at grantandstuff.